welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. Today's program, we look at the untold history of the United States, deeply researched by an American University team of historians led by Dr. Peter Kuznick. The 10-hour documentary series by Oliver Stone and accompanying book provide a provocative challenge to the status quo of American historical interpretation in the tradition of the late Howard Zinn. Welcome to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. Today's program, we look at the untold history of the United States. We have for you several excerpts from the series Untold History of the United States by Oliver Stone. Well, one of the notable features of this series is the information on important men and women who've become unjustifiably obscure in recent years in particular. One of these historical characters in the United States was Henry Wallace, who was vice president during Franklin Roosevelt's third term, but was dropped from the 1944 ticket by Democratic Party bosses in favor of Harry Truman, who then succeeded to the presidency when Roosevelt died in 1945 near the end of World War II. Wallace remained in the cabinet as Secretary of Commerce, but his outspoken advocacy of peace and coexistence with the USSR irritated the hawks in the Truman administration, prompting Truman to fire Wallace. Here's a segment from the series Untold History of the United States.
The only way to defeat communism in the world is to do a better and smoother job of production and distribution. Let's make it a clean race. A determined race, but above all, a peaceful race in the service of humanity. The source of all our mistakes is fear. Russia fears Anglo-Saxon encirclement. We fear communist penetration. Out of fear, great nations have been acting like cornered beasts, thinking only of survival. The common people of the world will not tolerate imperialism, even under enlightened Anglo-Saxon atomic bomb auspices. The destiny of the English-speaking people is to serve the world, not dominate it.
Following Churchill's speech, conditions deteriorated rapidly. When Soviet troops stayed in northern Iran beyond their March deadline, Truman threatened war. He wrote,
"If the Russians were to control Iran's oil, either directly or indirectly, it would be a serious loss for the economy of the Western world."
Truman later privately claimed to a hardline senator that he gave the Soviets a nuclear warning, telling their ambassador, "If Soviet troops are not out in 48 hours, we're going to drop it on you." They were out, he claimed, in 24. The Soviets did withdraw, but probably for reasons other than atomic blackmail. Less than 2 months later, the U.S. cut off desperately needed reparation payments from West Germany to the Soviet Union. And in July of 46, sending another chilling message about its intentions, the U.S. decided to proceed with an atomic bomb test in the Marshall Islands. In September 46, in front of 20,000 people at New York's Madison Square Garden, Henry Wallace tried to put a stop to the growing madness.
"The tougher we get, the tougher the Russians will get. We can get cooperation once Russia understands that our primary objective is neither saving the British Empire nor purchasing oil in the Near East with the lives of American soldiers. Under friendly, peaceful competition, the Russian world and the American world will gradually become more alike. Russians will be forced to grant more and more of the personal freedoms, and we shall become more and more absorbed with the problems of social economic justice."
The speech became world news, deeply embarrassing to Secretary of State Jimmy Burns, who told Truman either he or Wallace had to go. Support for Wallace poured in throughout the ensuing controversy from such as Eleanor Roosevelt and Albert Einstein, but not from the Truman administration. James Forrestal regarded Wallace as at best a security risk and secretly had his Naval Intelligence Unit monitoring the Secretary of Commerce and shared information with the FBI's J. Edgar Hoover, who harbored deep suspicions about Wallace's loyalties. Wallace, in turn, considered Hoover an American Himmler. Truman later denied he had read and approved the entire speech in advance, which he had. He wrote in his diary,
"Wallace is a pacifist 100%. He wants us to disband our armed forces, give Russia our atomic secrets, and trust a bunch of adventurers in the Kremlin Politburo. I do not understand a dreamer like that."
Truman fired Wallace, and with his departure, the best chance to avert a nuclear arms race was gone. 1947 would be the turning point as the U.S. plunged headlong into the Cold War at home and abroad. Behind the ongoing liberation movements in places such as British Malaya, French Indochina, and Dutch Indonesia, U.S. leadership painted a dire picture of Stalin spreading world revolution, ruling out negotiations and ignoring any grays in its black and white conclusions. In Greece, the British Army toppled the popular leftist National Liberation Front and restored the monarchy and right-wing dictatorship, sparking a communist-led uprising. Following the severe winter of 1946-7, the financially strapped British could not control the revolt and asked the United States to take the lead in defeating the Greek insurgents and modernizing the Turkish army. One State Department official later summed it up: Great Britain had within the hour handed the job of world leadership to the United States. A war-weary public had no appetite for costly initiatives, but Truman, addressing both houses of Congress, appealed for $400 million, laying out a new vision for America as the world's policeman.
"The very existence of the Greek state is today threatened by the terrorist activities of several thousand armed men led by communists. At the present moment in world history, nearly every nation must choose between alternative ways of life. I believe that it must be the policy of the United States to support free peoples who are resisting attempted subjugation by armed minorities or by outside pressures."
Truman, in not distinguishing vital threats from peripheral ones, and by linking the fate of people all over the world to the security of the United States, was making a momentous statement. These words could in fact be transposed to Korea, to Vietnam, to Iraq and Afghanistan. After a heated debate, Congress fell into line. Moscow was stunned by this warlike language, accusing the U.S. of imperialist expansion under the guise of charity and trying to extend the Monroe Doctrine to the old world.
That's the voice of filmmaker Oliver Stone from his series Untold History of the United States, researched and co-written by Peter Kuznick at American University.
You know, if you look at most American history books, Henry Wallace gets like a footnote. And yet here is one of the top American people, vice president, who really would have put us in a different direction if he hadn't been manipulated out of in the 1944 Democratic Convention, out of being vice president. Truman came in, we used the nuclear weapons, we bombed Japan, a Cold War emerged. Henry Wallace would have been a totally different understanding of what would have happened in the future there. That is an amazing piece of story that we should all know and not be forgotten. So that's part of this untold history of the U.S.
We're going to move now to another excerpt from the Untold History of the United States, Oliver Stone and Peter Kuznick. Moving now to 1962, here is part of their section on the Cuban Missile Crisis, when for a time nuclear war seemed imminent. This section depicts the misjudgments, misinformation, and pressure for war on both sides, and how an officer on a Soviet submarine may have prevented a naval confrontation from escalating into war.
On October 27th, an incident occurred that Schlesinger described as not only the most dangerous moment of the Cold War, it was the most dangerous moment in human history. The Russian ships were heading toward the quarantine line. One of four Soviet submarines sent to protect the ships was being hunted all day by the carrier USS Randolph. More than 100 miles outside the blockade, the Randolph began dropping depth charges, unaware the sub was carrying nuclear weapons. Commander Valentin Savitsky tried without success to reach the general staff. He assumed the war had already started and they were going to die in disgrace for having done nothing. He ordered the nuclear torpedo to be prepared for firing. He turned to the other two officers aboard. Fortunately for mankind, the political officer, Vasily Arkhipov, was able to calm him down and convince him not to launch, probably single-handedly preventing nuclear war. In the midst of this harrowing confrontation, the breakpoint came when the National Security Council received word that a U-2 plane had been shot down over Cuba. Khrushchev had not authorized this. The Joint Chiefs wanted to act immediately and take out all the firing sites and missiles. Kennedy said no. The shooting down of the U-2 made both Kennedy and Khrushchev realize they were losing control of their enormous military machines. Americans receiving continual television broadcasts were paralyzed in the grip of something they had only dreamed about. Robert McNamara later said, as he watched the sunset come over the Potomac Saturday night, the 27th of October,
"It was a beautiful fall evening, height of the crisis, and I went up into the open air to look and to smell it, because I thought it was the last Saturday I would ever see."
In a last desperate effort, Kennedy sent his brother to meet with the Soviet ambassador, Anatoly Dobrynin, on that Saturday to tell him the United States was about to attack unless it received an immediate Soviet commitment to remove its bases from Cuba. Dobrynin conveyed the urgency to Khrushchev, who claimed in his memoirs that Robert Kennedy's message was even more desperate, that the president is not sure that the military will not overthrow him and seize power. The next morning, a Sunday, October the 28th, dawned with mercy. Soviets announced they would withdraw the missiles. The world breathed as if there was only one collective breath for all. The crisis would actually continue behind the scenes for 3 more weeks and finally ended on November 22 when the Soviets were able to regain control of their battlefield nuclear weapons from the Cubans. The weapons would actually leave Cuba. It's interesting to note in hindsight that during the entire crisis, Soviet missiles were never fueled, Red Army reservists were not called up, and no threats were made against Berlin. 30 years later, in 1992, McNamara was shocked when told that if American troops had invaded, not only were there 4 times as many armed Soviets in Cuba as reported, but 100 battlefield nuclear weapons would likely have been used. Realizing that 100,000 Americans would probably have died, McNamara said the U.S. would have responded by wiping out Cuba with the high risk of an all-out nuclear war between the U.S. and the Soviet Union. Hundreds of millions of people might have perished, possibly all mankind. Military leaders were furious when the crisis ended without an attack on Cuba. McNamara recalled their bitterness.
"The president invited the chiefs in to thank them for their support during the crisis, and there was one hell of a scene. Curtis LeMay came out saying, 'We lost. We ought to just go in there today and knock them off.'"
It was Khrushchev, even more than Kennedy, who deserves the lion's share of credit for having avoided war. And for this, he was vilified. The Chinese charged Khrushchev with cowardice for caving in. Much of the Pentagon, however, believing that its willingness to go to war had forced the Soviets to back down, determined that superior force would also work elsewhere, especially in Vietnam, where it was necessary once more to make a stand against communism.
That's the voice of Oliver Stone, filmmaker, narrating over his own series, Untold History of the United States. And the companion book to that, Untold History of the United States, co-authored by Professor Peter Kuznick of American University.
You know, listening to that clip, and that was just a 5-minute segment of a 12-hour series, it was chilling. The idea that the U.S. was depth charging a nuclear-loaded submarine Russian submarine that could have taken that carrier out quite easily was just kind of chilling that we were that close to nuclear exchange, a war that happened at that time. And it certainly puts in context the reemergence of the Cold War rhetoric that's happening around the Ukraine today. We need certainly people to be thinking along the lines of not having wars at these levels. And this history is so important for us all to know where we've come from, what happened at that time.
Oliver Stone and Peter Kuznick have both been on the Project Censored show several times before. They were on our JFK 50th anniversary program. Peter Kuznick has been on the program several times talking about these untold histories, these censored, underreported histories, very important alternative narratives to the official top-down managed news narratives that we get in the United States. You're listening to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. We're going to play another clip here about Richard Nixon from Oliver Stone and Peter Kuznick's series. Again, this video series created by director Oliver Stone, historian Peter Kuznick. Here's part of their coverage of the presidency of Richard Nixon. On the one hand, Nixon is signing landmark environmental legislation, improved voting rights, opened diplomatic relations with China, but he also escalated the Vietnam War and authorized dirty tricks against political opponents. The Watergate scandal eventually ended his presidency, but as Stone and Kuznick see it, that also fueled the later rise of the ultra-right wing of the Republican Party. Here's that clip.
In 1970, Attorney General John Mitchell gloated, "This country is going so far right that you are not going to recognize it." But how much further to the right could the U.S. go? In 1970, there was Vietnam, Cambodia, Laos, nuclear threats, surveillance, sabotage, dirty tricks, official lies, racial polarization, crime, and still to come were the war on drugs, Chile, and Watergate. But compared to the world that Ronald Reagan and George W. Bush would usher in, one could almost look back nostalgically on the Nixon era. Right-wing forces have always operated freely and openly in the dark chasms of American life, where racism, militarism, imperialism, and blind devotion to private enterprise festered. The raw underbelly of fanaticism has spawned groups as disparate as the Ku Klux Klan, Nazi Party, the Liberty League, the American Firsters, the John Birchers, the McCarthyites, and the Tea Party, spewing either hatred, bigotry, or simply ignorance of history. Beginning with Nixon's courting of a new Republican South and the success of George Wallace as a third-party candidate, these forces migrated from the fringes of American politics and the nether reaches of rationality to a new home in the Republican Party, which gradually banished its once thriving moderate and liberal wings. Nixon had once said that domestic politics interested him about as much as building outhouses in Peoria. But on his watch, whether he liked it or not, 18-year-olds won the vote, censorship declined, and gays and lesbians emerged from the shadows. He established the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, supported the Equal Rights Amendment, and new regulations governing the health of workers, and even strengthened the Voting Rights Act. His former right-wing allies were belatedly recognizing that this was not the 1950s anti-communist hatchet man Richard Nixon they had known. Though he was pulverizing Southeast Asia, he horrified the right when he turned around and, seeking to ease the stresses of the U.S. land war in Asia, recognized Red China in 1972. And on top of that, he went to the Soviet Union and signed the historic SALT I Treaty, placing limits on missile and anti-missile systems. When Nixon took the country off the gold standard and imposed wage and price controls in 1971, and then pulled all remaining U.S. troops out of Vietnam in 73, it seemed he had lost his mind and totally betrayed his base. By the time of Watergate, Nixon had made far too many enemies on both left and right than he could afford. Facing a probable impeachment, he resigned on August 9, 1974. The presidency was now in the hands of the amiable Gerald Ford, a man who Lyndon Johnson said could not fart and chew gum at the same time. Ford announced that our long national nightmare is over, but sending all the wrong signals, pardoned Nixon.
An absolute pardon unto Richard Nixon for all offenses against the United States which he, Richard Nixon, has committed or may have committed.
But even more troubling for the future was that Nixon's fall brought out the deepest impulses of rage and revenge from the core of Nixon's new Republican Party. His legendary anger became theirs, but now directed against the government itself. Reinvigorated by anger at a so-called liberal media, which had played such a toxic role in their mind in distorting Vietnam and driving Nixon from the presidency, a network of conservative think tanks as well as rich foundations invested large sums of money to push for their agendas. Among these was a radical return to the concept of privatization that had been, in their minds, destroyed by Roosevelt's loathed New Deal. Roosevelt's old enemies, the moneyed class, were back. This burgeoning right-wing network had little use for a relative moderate like Gerald Ford, and itched to put a real right-winger like former Governor Reagan of California into the White House.
And indeed, we have seen a massive shift to the right in the United States since the Nixon presidency, the Reagan presidency. Would have to also add the Clinton, of course, the Bush, Clinton, Bush, Obama presidencies have all seemed to be swinging to the right in many ways, fiscally, with globalization policies, foreign policies. We're playing excerpts of this very important history, this untold history of the United States by Oliver Stone and Peter Kuznick.
And again, the history as we see it from Oliver Stone and Peter Kuznick is enlightening for where we are today. Right-wing money. Corporations buying elections, the Koch brothers, you know, sort of throwing money out there to the private foundations and pushing this agenda, this right-wing corporatized agenda, is something that is not new. It's been around for a while, and knowing that history is vitally important for all people in this country, that we need to know the untold history and not allow the corporations to rewrite the history books the way they see it.
This is the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio, and we are listening to excerpts from The Untold History of the United States by Peter Kuznick and Oliver Stone. Oliver Stone narrates this series, and this segment we want to play for you right now looks at George W. Bush in the aftermath of the September 11th attacks. Bush ordered the invasion of Afghanistan. He then demanded and received congressional authorization to attack and invade Iraq. Although Iraq had nothing to do with the September 11th attacks, this segment from The Untold History of the United States looks at the Bush administration's actions as well as the cultural and media environment that helped enable Bush to have his way.
Although the security situation in Afghanistan worsened over the next 7 years and the U.S. presence grew from 2,500 to 30,000 troops, Afghanistan was a distraction to Bush. His attention was focused on toppling his father's old adversary, Saddam Hussein.
Evidence from intelligence sources, secret communications, and statements by people now in custody reveal that Saddam Hussein aids and protects terrorists, including members of Al-Qaeda.
As had Bill Casey in the 1980s and Lyndon Johnson in Vietnam, Bush used false intelligence.
There's no question that the leader of Iraq is an evil man. After all, he gassed his own people. We know he's been developing weapons of mass destruction.
UN inspectors searched high and low, visiting sites identified by the CIA. They found nothing, but Bush insisted the WMD were there.
The British government has learned that Saddam Hussein recently sought significant quantities of uranium from Africa.
Bush told Bob Woodward of the Washington Post around this time,
"I do not need to explain why I say things. I don't feel like I owe anybody any explanations."
These were extraordinary times. Words took on new meanings, fulfilling George Orwell's prophecies of doublespeak in his novel 1984. First they steal the words, then they steal the meaning. Words like axis of evil, war against terror, regime change, simulated drowning, preventive war. Civilians killed were now collateral damage. CIA kidnappings were now extraordinary renditions. And that most patriotic concept, the homeland, grew into a gargantuan new federal agency as labyrinthine as the Pentagon. The French philosopher Voltaire in the 18th century observed, "Those who can make you believe absurdities can make you commit atrocities." The descent into unreality was dizzy. Black Hawk Down, another popular Oscar-nominated film, appeared in late 2001, glorifying American heroism and technology in 1990s Somalia. Technology, video games became more and more lifelike. And on television, increasingly bizarre and fanciful reality game shows prospered in the ratings.
Jenna, the tribe has spoken.
U.S. media beat the drums of war. MSNBC, which was owned by General Electric, canceled Phil Donahue's popular primetime show 3 weeks before the invasion. Officials feared the show would provide a home for the liberal anti-war agenda at the same time our competitors are waving the flag at every opportunity. And wave the flag they did. CNN, Fox, NBC paraded over 75 retired generals and officers, almost all of whom were later revealed to be working directly for military contractors. Pentagon officials gave them talking points, portraying Iraq as an urgent threat. Major newspapers and magazines, including the New York Times, advanced the same message. One Bush insider told journalist Ron Suskind that Suskind represented the reality-based community. But that's not the way the world works anymore. We're an empire now, and when we act, we create our own reality. When France, Germany, and Russia, as well as most of the Security Council, refused to support the U.S. position, Bush was furious and Rumsfeld sneered.
"You're thinking of Europe as Germany and France. I don't. I think that's old Europe."
French fries in the congressional cafeteria were renamed Freedom Fries, just as sauerkraut became Liberty Cabbage during World War I. Bush laid out his new strategy in a speech to the cadets at West Point in June 2002.
"We must take the battle to the enemy, disrupt his plans, and confront the worst threats before they emerge."
The U.S. would act unilaterally and preemptively to overthrow any government deemed a threat to U.S. security. Cheney had declared,
"If there's a 1% chance Pakistani scientists are helping Al-Qaeda build or develop a nuclear weapon, we have to treat it as a certainty in terms of our response."
"In the world we have entered, the only path to safety is the path of action, and this nation will act."
60 countries made it onto Bush's potential hit list, with Bush calling for a moral crusade, saying that the United States must defend liberty and justice because these principles are right and true for all people everywhere.
"Moral truth is the same in every culture, in every time, and in every place."
It was a bold statement of American exceptionalism. Bruce Bartlett, who served in both the Reagan and first Bush administrations, explained,
"This is why George W. Bush is so clear-eyed about Al-Qaeda and the Islamic fundamentalist enemy. He understands them because he's just like them. He truly believes he's on a mission from God. The whole thing about faith is to believe things for where there's no empirical evidence."
"I have a sense of calm, knowing that the Bible's admonition thy will be done, is life's guide.
In early October 2002, Congress empowered Bush to go to war against Iraq on his own authority whenever he deemed it appropriate, using whatever means, including nuclear weapons, he felt necessary. The resolution drew a direct connection between Iraq and al-Qaeda. Among those authorizing this were Senators John Kerry and Hillary Clinton.
That's Oliver Stone narrating in his series Untold History of the United States, researched with Professor Peter Kuznick of American University. You're listening to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. Looking at the untold history of the United States, Oliver Stone, Peter Kuznick, very important way of looking back and interpreting the past by looking at facts that have been obscured, ignored, were brief footnotes in some of the major corporate textbooks, the documentaries that people see a lot on cable. This was a real breakthrough, this untold history. Not only is it out on a major publisher as a book, but it was on Showtime. It's available on DVD at Warner Brothers. It's very important because they look at some seriously fundamental issues about the construction of history, how we remember history. And Michael Parenti, the political scientist, author of many books, including History as Mystery, once wrote, "Those engaged in the manufacturing of history often introduce distortions at the point of origin well before the history is written or even played out. This initial process of control is not usually left to chance, but is regularly pursued by interested parties who are situated to manipulate the record." So, Peter, we really have our work cut out for us. We not only have this top-down managed news, censorship and propaganda of the media in the present, we have to deal with a body of history, of distorted history that tends to support the establishment and the status quo. And, of course, in this untold history, goes back to take another look at some key issues in the 20th century.
Certainly like the Project Censored books and this untold history text, as you look at it, it's giving us an interpretation that allows us to understand better what's going on in the world today. I mean, you had this ideological split between capitalism and communism, and that's how it was portrayed. There was this fear of the communism empire trying to take over the world, and the capitalists were really afraid of that, and they really believed that. And then as Russia not only acquired the capabilities of an atom bomb and then later a nuclear bomb, but they were the first to come up with an intercontinental ballistic missile. And they were the first to get a satellite in space. And, that freaked out a whole lot of people in the American establishment. And then leading right up to 62, during the Cuban Missile Crisis, the U.S. is dropping depth charges on a Soviet submarine that has nuclear capabilities and could have, in fact, taken our aircraft carrier just completely out of the water. But thankfully, that Russian captain didn't use the capabilities that he had, and we avoided the beginnings of a nuclear war in October of 62.
That's very important history, going back, looking through the 20th century at key events. Of course, Stone and Kuznick look at key figures, major figures. Of course, we know the late historian Howard Zinn looked at a people's history and people's movements, and that's also part of what's in the untold history. But they also look at different interpretations of these major events, certainly JFK to the brink. It's interesting, given Oliver Stone's expertise and fascination with JFK, the book doesn't go in so much to the assassination of JFK, but what's fascinating is the historical context where it isn't such that JFK is assassinated in November of 1963 that turns out to be so shocking. As Peter Kuznick and Oliver Stone describe, Kennedy had so many enemies and so many people that he was angering because of some of the possible policies he was going to be pursuing. It's really important to go back and remember that 50 years later. And
withdrawal from Vietnam, detente with the Russians, peace with Cuba.
Scattering the CIA, right? Blowing it
Kennedy
to the winds.
Kennedy was certainly lining up a lot of the military-industrial complex establishment for modification, and they didn't go for it. So that was certainly part of that.
George Orwell wrote, "Who controls the past controls the future. Who controls the present controls the past." This is why it's very important that people understand the past and understand that there are actors throughout history There are chroniclers, journalists, others, those in power. They record history in a way that looks more favorably on themselves, right? Winston Churchill, once upon a time, speaking to a room of his peers, said, history will be kind to us before I intend to write it. And that's very important to remember, which is why we really need to look at what Peter Kuznick and Oliver Stone are writing here. Michael Parenti, the political scientist we noted earlier, also wrote in History as Mystery that history is not just what historians say it is, but what government agencies, corporate publishing conglomerates, chain store distributors, mass media pundits, editors, reviewers, and other ideological gatekeepers want to put into circulation. Not surprisingly, the deck is stacked to favor those who deal the cards. And one must ask, right, how might those dealing the cards influence the reporting of news, right, framing, controlling information? And by hiding the people's past and hiding certain interpretations of history, we're really tying people's hands in the present to not have a full grasp or full understanding of the things that are going on, like in places like the Ukraine, right? It's Cold War redux. We see a lot of this Cold War propaganda resurfacing, and Oliver Stone and Peter Kuznick go and look at a whole Cold War history. We think it's very important that people go back, look at this history, and have a context to understand and deconstruct what's going on in the present. Peter?
That leads us right into Bush, the false intelligence to invade Iraq, Iraq being portrayed as evil, this simplistic dichotomy, weapons of mass destruction, the introduction of terminologies like collateral damage, rendition, homeland security, all part of that Bush era. That leads us even up to the present with Obama and the continuation of that. It gives us a context of understanding of what our policies have been in Libya, Syria, Ukraine, Venezuela, El Salvador, in just in the last few years. And the context for that in terms of is U.S. trying to, along with NATO, develop this global empire of power, pro-capitalism everywhere, and take out any opposition, any governments that side with the people, so to speak, in their regions. That's a policy that I think we need to collectively understand and not take a look at things in isolation, but understand that there is an empire advantage here that the U.S. is involved with, and the utilization of NATO. It is not only pro-capitalist, but pro-corporate, in that they want money to be able to go anywhere in the world and be free to be used and expanded, and whatever exploitation that happens in terms of the people there, that's disregarded.
Well, it's also the case when we look back at a history of this empire, U.S. empire, the U.S. NATO empire. You know, in the last Project Censored book, 2014, the late Brian Murphy did a very important chapter on AFRICOM and U.S. interest in Africa, and we're seeing that right now. We're seeing that just in the recent last week or so, we're now seeing these stories about girls being sold into slavery in Nigeria, and that's a terrible thing. It's a horrible thing that's happening. But what's also interesting about it is the way that the Obama administration and the corporate news media have seized upon this as some new justification to have more overt operations of the U.S. in Africa and AFRICOM. And, you know, again, we're supposed to sit and think that, oh, this has nothing to do with coltan, the mineral in cell phones, or this has nothing to do with oil. We're somehow always led to believe that the United States is on this benevolent kind of mission. And that's, of course, part of our historical narrative. That's part of our historical mythology in the United States. And what's very important, again, is that, you know, this untold history of the United States, Oliver Stone, Peter Kuznick, is, you know, a really great installment in terms of getting people to think critically about how these mythological narratives shape the way we see things and the way we just accept things in the present, as if these stories are packaged for us and they fit right in, right? The same with the myths of America entering World War I to make the world safe for democracy. I mean, there was an amazing amount of propaganda going on World War I with Edward Bernays, the Creel Commission, the Committee on Public Information, you know, where for the first time in the United States we had an official government agency literally propagandizing the public. World War II, the propaganda surrounding what went on at Pearl Harbor as if it was a sneak attack, even though all the information we had about that it was coming is sort of just buried in the past. It's very important to go back and unpack those stories. Peter, you were just talking about up to the present with Obama, the euphemistic language that surrounds this, all the false statements in the Bush administration on the run-up to the war in Iraq. back. You know, we need to make sure that people are aware of this history. We need to make sure people remember that there were 935 false statements made about Iraq and weapons of mass destruction by the Bush administration. We need to remember that they manufactured this war in Iraq, and they called it a war on terror that Obama has embraced and escalates through drone strikes, and they call them unmanned aerial vehicles, not drones, right? And it's important here also, we could cite Noam Chomsky, who said, "For those who stubbornly seek freedom around the world, there can be no more urgent task than to come to understand the mechanism and practices of indoctrination. Propaganda is to democracy what violence is to totalitarianism." And I think it's very important to understand this history. Oliver Stone and Peter Kuznick are giving us, in, again, the Untold History of the United States DVD and book.
I like what President Gorbachev says about this research. He said, "Oliver Stone and Peter Kuznick provide a critical overview of U.S. foreign policy, and there's much to reflect on here. The U.S. can choose to be the policeman of a Pax Americana," I like to say Pax Americana, "which is a recipe for disaster, or partner with other nations on the way to a safer, more just, and sustainable future." So those are some of the beliefs of, and ideologies that we're playing with here. And this isn't going to be an American peace. It will be an American disaster if we insist upon continuation of a global empire of power.
Again, it's very important to remember this. Bill Maher said that finally a book with the guts to challenge the accepted narrative of recent American history. Glenn Greenwald from The Intercept, who broke the Edward Snowden story, said about The Untold History, "As riveting, eye-popping, and thought-provoking as any history book you will ever read, can't recommend it highly enough." And again, it's just important to get people thinking about and talking about history, Peter, because people walk around in an ahistorical bubble. Many people in the United States are very unaware of not only their own history, but clearly the history of the world. Sadly, often we have these dark humor jokes that foreign policy and warfare is the way Americans learn about geography. That's a terribly tragic result of ignorance and ignorance of the past. And, of course, we've all heard the axiom, those that don't know their history or don't remember their history are condemned to repeat it. And I think that it's very important we have historical conversations, and Oliver Stone and Peter Kuznick have given us a great invitation, a great way to do so with these DVDs and book. We're going to now share with you something we call the Project Censored Validated Independent News. And today we have Project Censored student intern Alexandria McDowell talking to us about Apple and the dubious business practices of the Apple Corporation.
For Project Censored, I'm Alexandria McDowell with today's Validated Independent News story. Apple is the most valuable brand in the world, worth an approximate $98 billion. One would expect that such a company would be above taking financial shortcuts. However, a January 2014 assessment by Nikki Lisa Cole at Counterpunch reveals disturbing malpractices by the company. It included profiting from unregulated tin mining in Indonesia, unlawful labor in China, tax evasion, gouging the Los Angeles public school system, and using surveillance technology for profit. In 2013, many tech companies admitted to purchasing tin, used in virtually every electronic device, from unregulated mines in Indonesia. Apple, however, refused to disclose where it sources its tin, even after Friends of the Earth, an international network of environmentalists, mobilized 25,000 people to write the company in protest. Use of unlawful labor extends into China, where reports from SACOM and the China Labor Watch document deplorable working conditions, including 100-hour work weeks, high levels of underage student labor, and unlivable wages, even though Apple had joined the Fair Labor Association in 2012. Cole also reports on iBeacon, an app for the company's popular iPhone and iPad, that Apple claims acts as a so-called personal shopper. Specifically, the program pushes sales offers and notifications to customers as they browse Apple stores. Privacy advocates have been warning against this type of technology for years. Cole writes that Apple has taken a public stance against widespread digital surveillance technology for its own profits. News of Apple's mercenary business practices have begun to emerge in U.S. corporate media and may be gathering steam, particularly since the New York Times covered Apple's tax evasion record and the Los Angeles Times reporting on Apple's $1 billion deal with the Los Angeles Unified School District. Apple has carved out its permanent place in the world of technology, and we need to hold them accountable for their deplorable actions. However, I wouldn't count on corporate media doing so. This has been Alexandria McDowell with Project Censored. This underreported news story was researched by Brian Brennan with Diablo Valley College and evaluated by faculty Mickey Huff, also with Diablo Valley College, as part of Project Censored's Validated Independent News Program. For more Validated Independent news stories, go to projectcensored.org and follow the link for Validated News.
Thanks for tuning in to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. Thanks to Anthony Fest, our producer, and Kirsten Thomas at the controls. The Project Censored Show airs on over a dozen stations around the U.S. Archives can be found online at projectcensored.org. Please follow and like us on Facebook. Thanks for joining us this week. We'll see you next time.